Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 233rd episode of the Atlas Society Asks. My name is Lauren Salivo, Senior Project Manager here at the Atlas Society, the leading nonprofit organization introducing young people to the ideas of Ayn Rand in creative ways like animated videos and graphic novels. Our CEO, Jennifer Grossman, has the week off, but I'm excited to have join me Atlas Society Senior Scholar Richard Salzman and Senior Fellow Antonella Marti for a webinar exploring populism, what it is, why it gains followers, and how it can appear in collectivist movements on both sides of the political spectrum. Richard, Antonella, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Lawrence.
Lawrence.
Great to do this. Thank you so much. And Antonella, it's so wonderful to work with you again. I agreed to start with an opening and then turn to Antonella, who has just written a wonderful booklet called How to Spot a Populist, which is fabulous. The subtitle, Understanding the Appeal and Dangers of Demagoguery. So Antonella and I talked and exchanged some notes ahead of time. What we were hoping to do, we have limited time, but first of all, what is it? What is populism? Can we define it a little bit, if we can, about the roots and origins of it, the effects of it? Antonella has written wonderfully on the idea that it seems to be right-wing and left-wing. So how does it relate to the spectrum? Is populism, you know, like a separate type of ideology, like socialism or capitalism, or is it something different entirely? And then we did want to get a little bit, if we could, into actual history of it. When did this first rear its head? Why is it rearing its head again? Is it different in Latin America versus America versus Europe? I have a query of, like, why don't we see it in Asia? But that's a separate question. So, Antonella, I thought I would just start, not so much interviewing you, but since you've written on this recently and so wonderfully, how would you, I know you start right off saying, what is this? What, see if you could briefly tell the audience, what do you think it is? What populism is?
Thank you, Richard. It's always great to work with you. And yeah, when it comes to populism, I want to, and I like to define it as a political strategy, not as a ideology, but a political strategy, a way to do politics. And I think populism has become a relevant phenomenon in the 21st century politics. I mean, we can see it practically everywhere. Here in Latin America, we can see populism. In the US, we can see populism. In the case of Europe, we can see a lot of populist movements rising everywhere, in every single country, with this at some point right-wing and nationalist political parties. I think, like, during this decade, the thing when it comes to ideologies into populism is the right wing ideology using this modus operandi of populism, of doing politics. And if we think about 10 years ago or 20 years ago, in the case of Latin America, for example, there was this phenomenon of populism, but it was more related to a left-wing populism. But I think that populism as a phenomena defines the 21st century politics, and it, I think it challenges the established conceptions of how power is exercised and how societies are even structured. I mean, its impact has been significant, reshaping the political landscape around the world and generating these intense debates about democratic values and institutions. So at the end of the day, it comes to when it comes to populism, we need to understand the importance of democracy and how these populist leaders that we can identify with some characteristics that they share in common, when it comes to democracy, they see it as a threat, but they use democracy to get into power. That's something that most populists do. So that's how I would identify populism. And that's why I think that we need to pay attention to concepts like populism, to identify the problems and the visions of our politics and our society. But what do you think? How would you define a populist leader?
Well, appeal to the general will, we know that that is in going way back in Rousseau, the idea of the general will, and well, who was supposed to identify and represent this general will or this popular will, versus the Lockean view that we have individual rights and goal, government's sole function is to protect individual rights. So I think it traces at least as far back as that, but possibly earlier. But one of the things I like in your booklet is you say it's not the same as popular. You can have a politician or a candidate who's pro freedom, pro liberal, and popular. And so it's not that the general public is endorsing. Is it has that etymology, doesn't it? The idea of popular. And yet, on the other hand, if it's popular will, if it's the idea that the sovereignty lies in the people, even the American documents start with "we the people," the Constitution. But it doesn't say whatever the people want is legitimate. It says that they are the ones that elect the elected, and then the elected are. As you stress in your booklet, restricted constitutionally to protecting rights. So, but I think of populism as you can appeal in medieval time. Remember, it was Vox Dei, the voice of God, and then for that wonderful brief period in the Enlightenment, it was the voice of reason. We were to appeal not to God, but to reason to justify our actions and justify our governments. And I believe, and I think you stress this as well, with the decline of respect for reason, and with the decline, as you said it, in confidence, say in objectivity, people have to turn to something, and they're not, maybe thankfully, willing to go back to medievalism, but the one that remains is the voice of the people, and the phrase was Vox Populi, and sometimes they would put it together and say Vox Populi, Vox Dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. So I think of populism as, I agree with you, it's a technique, it's a modus operandi, but it's also this idea that that is where my power comes from, and this is the populist leader saying this, and I'm legitimized because that's the only form of legitimation anymore. It's not based on reason and principles and rights and things like that. Actually, the subtitle of your booklet, Demagoguery, and you mentioned democracy. Maybe we should talk a little bit about, since democracy is considered the premier, almost unquestioned form of government, not so much constitutionally limited government. Demagoguery, democracy, demos meaning the people, rule by the people. Demagoguery has a bad connotation, right? Isn't it? How would you put it? Like its appeal to like the lower prejudices and the emotions and the fears and anxieties of people. Why do you think populists do that? Like, why don't they appeal to their, more optimistic outlooks and thing? Why does it seem to be on the downside?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Richard. And I see that it happens a lot in Latin America, and I can say that I see that in the US right now. But it's about people waiting for a messiah, people waiting for a savior, like a politician to save the country, to save the society from, I don't know, always an enemy that will come and destroy the fundamentals of the perfect idea of society that they present, right? Because every single populist present an idea of what a or a moral vision of the ideal society or so it's about people waiting for a politician to come and save them from all these enemies that they create, because sometimes they're not even real enemies. They even create these kind of ghosts So yeah, so when it comes to this booklet that I wrote, and it has the foreword written by David Kelly, I try to list some features to identify the populist messiah. And like the first one that I always mention is this idea of paternalism and messianism, like how this politicians are become this they many people think that they are like our parents or something like that. And they try to educate people or control people and tell you what to do and tell you what to think. So that's one of the features that I would say we need to understand when it comes to identifying the idea of the figure of the populist messiah, paternalism and this concept of the messiah. And then also the simplification of complicated problems of complex problems, I would say. They always offer simple solutions to complex social, economic, and political problems. So then comes nationalism, because I see nationalism as a trend right now in the world. I would say that nationalism is the biggest threat, the biggest collectivist threat of in basically the entire world. So it's nationalism that it could have like different ideologies. It could be from the left or the right. When it comes to Venezuela, for example, I would say that, I mean, I don't define what's happening in Venezuela as communism. I would say that
No.
is nationalism or a national populist dictatorship regime. Because I mean, Nicolas Maduro, he's always like, he says homeland or death, which is basically the same argument or slogan that these right wing leaders in Europe use. So it's I mean, it's not that Nicolas Maduro is talking about Marx and Engels and this communist concepts. It's not about that. I mean, Hugo Chavez used that, the concepts of socialism in the beginning, but right now I don't see like communism in Venezuela. So I think is nationalism. Nationalism is the biggest threat. And they promote this us versus them narrative. So they keep dividing society into the pure and the corrupt groups, or like the true citizens and the undesirable people. So this idea fosters isolation, xenophobia, and even creates these enemies that we were talking about earlier. It could be an immigrant, it could be different minorities, and another thing that I see when it comes to populist is like they always become bullies, right? So it's like, and I see it everywhere, like literally everywhere in Europe, here in Argentina, in Latin America, in the US. It's like politics is not about, it's not about debating or having a civilized conversation and debates and sharing ideas, but it's about trying to identify the bully and when it comes to politics. So I see politicians fighting because they want to be practically bullies. And
I think that point so fits nicely with the view at which I shared. This is a technique, a modus operandi. Notice the bullying or the ostracizing of people, and both sides do it. So it confirms this idea that it's a technique. It's a nasty technique. It's a vicious technique, but it's used by left, right, and I guess we wouldn't say center here, but right, that bullying idea that is and it could include censorship is a technique, isn't it? And deployed by the populace.
And even I think you mentioned it earlier, but this manipulation of voters' emotions, they appeal to charisma, they appeal to this because they have some exceptional communication skills. That's something every single populist have. So they use this kind of direct language that resonates with ordinary people's concerns and emotions, and they employ national symbols and emotional gestures and things to reinforce their image as leaders close to the people. So They often have a remarkable ability to connect with the masses through passionate and this through passionate oratory. So then you see this paternalism and clientelism and this all these messiahs that have those exceptional communication skills. So that's another characteristic to identify this populace, and of course the hostility toward established institutions. They are the enemies of the institutions. They're the biggest enemies of the rule of law, and that's when some concepts come like the idea of rule of law, because of course populists are narcissists. And they don't like limits. They don't like when you limit their power. They don't like when you limit the things that they can do and what they cannot do. So they will scream and they will, get mad if you try to limit their power. So
Yeah.
and they even tend to modify constitutional norms to ensure their perpetuation in power,
Yeah.
by changing the constitution. In
Yeah.
Venezuela, they had 27 constitutions, and this
Right.
is happening in countries like El Salvador. It's
Right.
happening everywhere.
And the willingness to reject a key principle of liberty, which is the independent judiciary. So if you run through the major branches of government, they'll often say these unelected, that's the key for them, these unelected robed jurists or these unelected bureaucrats. Now, you and I, we don't like the bureaucrats either at their status, but this idea that unless you've been elected popularly, unless you're a populist, we don't trust you and we don't. And so, didn't they also pack the court massively in Venezuela? This is always done. They add seats to the court, and that's a trend in the US as well. Antonella, I wanted to pick up on something you said because the paternalism of this is so interesting. And I think there's also, you could say, maternalism, because we've had ladies, right? We've had like Maria Le Pen and right and Evita Peron. And it's not as if there isn't a history of women doing it as well, but that speaks to your point that it's more technique than anything. But I've always thought that but political paternalism is so interesting and so sad because it's the society as family and the leaders are the parents, but that implies that the citizens are the children. And in many ways it's a distorted and inhuman type of setup, right? Because you should be able to mature beyond the family. You shouldn't, as a grown adult, feel the necessity of following politicians as father figures, with the rules and telling you what to do and how you should obey, and but also the social security aspect of it. You will take care of me. You will be my nanny. You will provide a social safety net from cradle to grave. That's a big part of this, isn't it? Because paternalism is a separate issue, but the populism relationship to paternalism is interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting, and it's part of it's part of the basis or the core of populism. And it's great that you mentioned Marine Le Pen in France, or we can even mention Giorgia Meloni in
Right,
Italy.
in
Like they
Italy.
present
Yep.
themselves as the mothers that
Yeah.
will
Right.
take care
Right.
of you. So there's always this idea of like the roles. What is the role of a mother, the role of a father? And
Yeah.
they divide this and play with this when it comes to politics. And of course it leads to a kind of a cult of personality,
Yeah.
because at the end it will be a cult of personality, because it has profound political implications, and I even say psychological roots that reveal a lot about the nature of these leaders that tend to centralize power around themselves, and then and they blur the lines between leadership and institutions. They present themselves as saviors, as
Yeah.
these figures that I mean, like without them, the country will fall into chaos. So this approach basically strengthens like their control as criticism or dissent is perceived as a personal attack on the leader. So then the cult of personality comes. And again, when it comes to rule of law, I think that's very important because they are parents. Like they don't like, I mean, they are not the ones who are limited by others. They put limits on other people. And other, I mean, in other people, it's just, citizens. It's us. So that's why they, touch the Constitution. They don't like constitutions. They don't like limits. They don't like democracy. They don't like justice. They don't like I don't know the Congress. I mean, even what happened in the U.S. Like January 6th, that was something that really shocked me because that's something I would expect in like I mean we got used to those attacks or movements in Latin America, but seeing that in a country like the US, I mean that's the heart of democracy. So when I saw that, I was like, this is what populism do. Like this is what happens when you let a politician become the basically the leader of a cult. So they got power. So it's not like, I mean, if they are the leaders of different cults or whatever, and they don't have any impact on society or legislations or whatever. I mean, that's another thing, but they decide for ourselves. They create laws. They propose public policy. So, yeah.
It the American case is interesting because the not too long ago the Tea Party movement, which was 2010 or 12 or so, was a bit more intellectual. They appealed to the Constitution. They thought Obamacare and that whole scheme was overthrowing the Constitution. When they gathered, and hundreds of thousands did gather together in various rallies, they were usually polite. There was usually no violence. They even picked up all their trash afterwards. The people remarked on how amazing it was. And the fact that they used the Tea Party imagery, which dates back to the founders, I think is also interesting and different from the current right-wing populism, which, as you've said, it's anti-intellectual, it's more physicalist. But the right today would say something like, "Well, we get to revolt if we feel our liberties are being threatened." But if you look at the American Revolution, yeah, that was surely a revolt. But interestingly, it was a revolt of aristocrats. The Hamiltons and the Jeffersons and the Washingtons and even the Sam Adams, they were writing pamphlets. They were intellectual. Yes, there was a physical aspect to it, but so different from the kind of madness of crowds that you see in the versions of the last 100 years or so. I wanted to pick up on what you said earlier about the us versus them approach, because anytime I hear us versus them, I realize it can go as far back as the peasant uprisings against kings and royals. But in a more immediate history, it's capital versus labor, right? It's Karl Marx saying the capitalist should be overthrown violently by the quote unquote exploited laborer. So that's at least 1840s Communist Manifesto. And just as the history, I think you mentioned this as well in your booklet, the history in Russia, how interesting, and America. Populist uprisings came in the wake of the Marxist argument. So we're talking 1880s, right? 1890s in Russia. I think Russia had populism, people advocating. You cite this a bit in your booklet. And in the US case, it began among farmers. So there it was, farmers versus Wall Street, or farmers versus the big bad railroads overcharging them, So it takes different forms. And I suppose today, this us versus them, today it looks like something like the common man or the ordinary people versus the elites. The elites defined as, well, this would be true no matter with the right, left, or center. The elites would be, well, they're credentialed, they have all these degrees, they have experience, long resumes, experience in government, right? But people look at them and they say, you got us in this mess to begin with. So do you agree that they make the error, I think, of saying, well, elite, the best and the brightest, that per se is the problem, and we need to go anti-intellectual. Whereas really isn't the problem that the elites and the intellectuals are not liberal in the good sense. They're not pro-capitalist. Is this what people are resenting? I know
And
you.
I think
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the elites, it could be anything. It could be anything the populace want. Even if, I mean, that's why we were talking, and I think it's very important what you said, because populism is not an ideology. So populists, they do this kind of they pick the different aspects or concepts of ideologies, or even different ideologies, because I see many people, I mean, even libertarians or classical liberals that nowadays talk about, you can at some point identify some nationalist narrative when it comes to their speech, even theocracy, like. And you mentioned the Tea Party earlier, and I think it's very important to talk about this connection between religion and politics, which is something that we can see nowadays, like everywhere. Here in Argentina, Javier Milei talks about the forces of heaven. So whenever he wants to argue about something, he uses the Bible to justify things, and he says that God talked to him and told him that his goal in life was to become president, and then he goes and says that his sister Karina Milei is some like a person of the Bible and stuff like that. So they use the Bible a lot. They use the religion a lot. They want to become, this kind of, again, saviors. They want to be, like a Jesus politician. I remember when I saw the January 6th assault on the Capitol. I remember that I saw like this images with flags that said Jesus 2020 and stuff like that. And then we go if we explore a little bit more, we can see the rise of this Christian nationalism basically everywhere in this in that movement, the right-wing movement in the US. So then you see the moral majority, and again, it's politicians telling you what to do, telling you what to think, telling you how you should behave, and they use these religious condiments to tell you what to do. So
In the case of Trump, who was never known to invoke religion, when he was a New York real estate developer, or even in the first campaign, 2016 or so. But interestingly, I found after the assassination attempt last summer, he started saying that the hand of God had intervened to save him. And now I know he must not believe any of that stuff. But it, as you would put it, this is his chance to evoke. He knows a large part of the populace believes that kind of stuff. So he's that's demagoguery in a way, right? He's not saying soak the rich and kill the rich and eat the rich, but he is appealing to an emotional aspect, not a rational aspect of, and that he's the chosen one, and it's kind of shameless. And you reminded me of that. Now the other thing is in your booklet you say. This is interesting. Left populism versus right populism. Left populism, you said, focuses on the struggle between different economic classes. Yeah, so that's more like the Marxist approach, right? And then,
Mm-hmm.
right, interestingly, you say right-wing populism focuses on, say, competition among groups within the nation or competition among nations, right? So this would be Trump saying, I'm going to have tariffs up against people who send too many things to America, too many goods, or immigrants, the whole thing. We can be for legal immigration and we can be for free trade, but that wing of the party is using it, right, to say, it's a zero-sum game. If they benefit, we lose. If we lose, they benefit. And it's a kind of a Marxist view of labor and capital, isn't it?
Yeah, and you said the chosen one, right?
Yeah.
So whenever these right-wing political parties or populists create this us versus them, this division of society, because they need to polarize
Yeah.
society, because they
Yeah.
need to create a monster that they will fight and that they will destroy. So they divide the problem, and they present themselves as the pure part of the society against the corrupt part of a society. And when they talk about corrupt, and even when they
Yeah.
talk about corruption, it's
Yeah.
not only in when it comes to politicians and bureaucrats stealing money and doing money laundering and stuff like that. No, it's a corruption of the purity of the society, of the idea of how like they see the country as the chosen one too.
Yeah.
Is the country is chosen by God to be
Yeah.
there, to
Right.
lead the example. And it makes me, it calls my attention, because I see many people, like even people that identify themselves as classical liberals, or even when it comes to objectivism and many different ideologies and even philosophy and ideas, because when it comes to classical liberalism, we know that it was born fighting against conservatism. It wasn't
Yeah.
like
Yeah.
it didn't start as an ideology to fight socialism. It
Right.
started with the these conservatives that wanted to, have religion and politics together. So classical liberal basically divided that toxic relationship between religion and the state.
Yeah.
So right now I see many people wanting to have that toxic relationship back again, like religion and the state. And we know that I mean the biggest genocides and even seas of blood, it was because of religious conflicts and nationalism. It has always been like that and about that. So
Yeah,
this chosen one,
we still have
absolutely.
religious wars going on in the Middle East. Yeah, I there's a section we don't have much more time, but I wanted to address these sections you have on solutions. But the segue here being, this is a great section here where you're saying, just as there's no such thing as good versus bad dictatorships, so also with populism, it's important to realize there's not good populism and bad populism. So as you say, today there's the rise of right-wing populism. I guess our message is just because you seem to be succeeding electorally, dear right-wingers, this doesn't make you pro-liberalism. It's not making you pro-capitalism. That's not, and it's a technique for gaining office, but for those of us who care about the free society, right? Antonella, that this is not going to help. And but you pinpoint, you put your finger on, I'm just quoting here selectively, where does this come from? A disoriented society, unquote. A quote, a society skeptical of objectivity. Another quote, vulnerable to appeals to tribal loyalties. Here's another one, anxiety and discontent. Lots of good stuff you write about, vulnerable to conspiracy theories, to uncertainty. It's very interesting because here we're kind of talking about electoral success and politics, but you're naming epistemological and psychological aspects where the populace is disoriented, the populace is in a bad way, and that could be due to bad education policies, a whole bunch of things, right? But here the issue is politicians cashing in on it instead of bringing better knowledge to the populace. It's taking that disorientation, right, and that vulnerability and that anxiety, and in a way exploiting it, even if it leads up in the case of Chavez Maduro, ends up just with a totally illiberal result. The psychological and epistemological aspects you're naming here are very important.
Yeah, thank you, Richard, for mentioning that. I think that instead of anxiety and fear and this conspiracy theories, we need more education. We need more critical thinking. We need people, and even young students, and you know, understanding that they don't have to run after conspiracy theories to explain everything, to explain stuff, because that's I mean, that's easy. And that's something that populists do. I mean, they know that people need answers. They know that people are craving for answers and to understand how things work. And of course, if they come and they tell you, well, so your problems are problems because there's a group of people doing this and they want to destroy you, blah, blah, blah. And it could be, I mean, we can put any name we want to that group of people destroying you.
It
So
was a
yeah,
great.
and I also want to thank you for quoting the good dictatorship and the bad dictatorship, because that's very important. I see many people defending, for example, Augusto Pinochet in Chile. Like, what was that dictatorship that he I mean, he killed many people. There was political repression, no rule of law. It even happened here in Argentina during the last military dictatorship in the 70s. My grandfather, he was killed by that military regime. We never knew what happened to him. We don't know where his body is, nothing. He was kidnapped in the 19 in 1977 because he had different ideas. So it happens everywhere. It happens a lot. And yeah, now we have democracies and we have rule of law in different countries. But I mean, it's not like we're vaccinated against dictatorships and nationalisms and populism. So we always need to be aware of this threat, right?
Let me end with a quote where you're very upbeat about this. You say the real, this is a quote from your booklet, the real solutions to the problems lies in strengthening constitutionally democratic education, encouraging citizen participation, promoting civil, inclusive, and respectful political dialogue, respecting individual rights, and educating new generations to embrace critical thinking from a perspective that offers proposals instead of being obsessed with attacking specific enemies. Then you end with defend, propose, debate, don't attack, divide, or seek to destroy ghosts or others, unquote. I love that. That's a you it's not just a critique you have here. You offer solutions. It's a wonderful book that everyone should get it. How to Spot a Populist. You can get it on Amazon and elsewhere and through the Atlas Society site as well, right, Lawrence? Antonella, I love talking about it with you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you. I always learn a lot about what about your ideas and your teachings. So I also want to thank you for that and for, you know, having this conversation with me and share all these topics and interesting concepts. So thank you.
Great. We'll see you around. Lawrence, you want to close us out?
Yes, thank you, Antonella. Thank you, Richard. A really great discussion. I want to thank everyone who's listening to this recording. We hope you enjoyed it. And just again, as Richard said, we encourage you to check out, there will be a link in the description section of this video, How to Spot a Populist: Understanding the Appeal and Dangers of Demagoguery, available on Amazon in both Kindle and paperback version, along with the Atlas Society website. If you enjoyed this video or any of our other materials, please consider a end of the year tax deductible donation at atlassociety.org/donate. And be sure to join us again next week on Thursday, January 2nd, where Atlas Society Senior Fellow Robert Trzezinski will be joined by our Student Programs Manager, Abby Perry, for a special 2024 in review. So for everyone watching this, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and we'll see you again in 2025. Richard, Antonella, thank you again. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, Lawrence.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Anthony. See you around.
Thank
Take
you.
care.
Bye bye. Thanks.